I'm going to move more or less straight into this conversation that I had with the Spaniard so that we get to fit it all in before the end of the show, because it's nearly an hour long. I hope you enjoy it as much as I do. I was listening to bits of it earlier on today, and I'm really looking forward to it. So here it is, the Spaniard from the White Rabbit Group.
Dr. Rock radio show on tnsradio.ning.com. I'm at the Sunrise Celebration 2011, where we had a bit of a Freeman frenzy the other night. We had a Freeman forum where several people gathered to discover different techniques and answer questions. And one of those people is a chap called Spaniard, who's on our team here, and he's going to hopefully talk to us a little bit about his methods and where he's come from. So hi, Tar, for coming in to talk to me.
Hiya, how you doing?
Oh, very good, thank you very much. Now, as far as I can gather, because we've had a bit of chats over the recent days, you used to be part of the machine. You were actually inside there doing the business. So how did you start off?
Well, like many people, I was part of the machine, and we're brought up to look at things in one particular way, and like most, I went out, did the best I could at school, fortunately did quite well, but only really, for, I suppose, from limited careers opportunity, was given the choices of banking, or the armed forces, or the police, or the NHS, or something like that, or university, and elected to go to banking, where I started off at Coutts, Queen's Bank, and didn't really progress there to the extent that I would have wanted, and then moved into American retail banking. So, okay. These are the kind of guys that would effectively have these branch centres, places like HFC Bank and City Financial, or yeah, as it was known at the time, Associates, so companies like that. Spent, 17 years moving from company to company.
Oh, were they genuinely retail banks at that stage?
They were genuinely retail banks, and I was a branch manager there. I used to fulfil some higher duties as well, and I used to think that I used to think of myself as relatively intelligent. I used to go to the nth degree and read the contracts and try to gain an understanding of how it all worked, read the policies, etc.
And did you try to help your clients understand the contracts?
I did with the eyes that I had at the time, let's put it that way. And so I can understand how people are confused by this whole perspective, if you like, when they suddenly see things for what they are and start asking questions. Because even working in that industry and thinking myself to be quite knowledgeable, I didn't know. And it's as simple as that. I didn't know, but it was for want of a legal dictionary or law dictionary, really. And that's
so
at the heart
of it.
So it
was purely and simply not realising that the words had two sets of meanings.
Absolutely. and as stupid and as ignorant as that sounds, and it probably was ignorant, but it's never spelt out. You know that there's this thing called the legal system, okay? You know that it applies to stuff if there's a conflict or something like that, and people have to go to court, but you don't actually understand the implications of documents that you're signing and so on and so forth, because it doesn't actually have written plainly on it, written in legalese.
And mostly we don't even read it anyway, do we?
No, absolutely. You trust, and from what's gone before and what you're taught, and you see your friends taking out loans or doing certain transactions or getting into certain contracts, and we take it for granted that we know how these things work, and therefore you then place a certain level of trust in whoever it is that's dealing or working for the company. They must know what they're talking about. They explain how it works. You're happy, you sign away, and off you go. But to suddenly then find out that, and I'll explain how I came to kind of find out and become awake to it all. But to suddenly find that everything that you've kind of believed in is completely and utterly 180 degrees in the mirror, it's a lot to take on board, and it takes a certain it takes an amount of time of processing, and even now I gain new understandings or understand certain processes in different ways and see the entirety of it in a slightly different perspective, or somebody explains things in their words and it adds a new dimension. So it really does get quite deep.
It does. And that suddenly the slow discovery that we are indeed, as you say, 180 degrees from where we thought we were, that we are in fact standing on the other side of the mirror, is a realization that comes to all of us. And I bet everybody listening to this program has had it, their kind of their moment of realization or their period of realization. So what was it after 17 or 18 years of working the donkey that made you suddenly
Well, and I did. I used to put the hours in, as many people do. I was, as I term it, a real Boy Scout. And, you know, I truly believed that, you know, if you put the hours in, your boss would recognise that and you'd get the reward and so on and so forth. And on with the rat race, it all continued. But I was working from a position where I had my own companies at that stage. And the credit crunch, or the alleged credit crunch, as I call it, hit home and completely wiped me out. And apart from the usual kind of difficulties that you have running a business and, you know, dealing with various parties and so on and so forth, it completely pulled the rug from under me. And so I was operating at the time as a mortgage broker. And so the natural thing for me, bearing in mind the industry I'd been involved with, bearing in mind my experience, was to literally then get involved with what we now term the claims management industry. So these companies that would offer to, you know, argue your credit card bill or something like that on a technicality.
Yeah.
And so I thought, saw that as a natural progression and started reading the relevant acts, you know, with greater depth, and realised that certainly as far as I could see, the documents that were coming to me from clients, three quarters didn't even tally up with the Acts of Parliament. I mean, we're talking incorrect interest rates, interest charges, they were totally voiding the contracts. But when you liaised, or when we liaised as a company with banks or finance companies, their attitude was to just ignore what was blatant in front of their faces and effectively stick two fingers up metaphorically. Which, you know, having been that side of the coin and having known what would happen had a client actually raised those issues with me, it would be a case of, well, yeah, okay, you've got a point, what's going on? You can't possibly ask someone to do this.
Yeah, you know? Yeah.
I'd never really encountered that. So, you know, being the other side of the coin, when it, you know, I'd actually left Main Street or the retail banking side of things before this all kind of kicked home. So I hadn't actually had to deal with that ever. But certainly the way that these banks were reacting was a way that was completely alien to me. And I was thinking, even from a service point of view, that this is ridiculous. You can't treat people like that.
Right.
Went into court on behalf of clients, was treated fairly poorly by the judge, which kind of raised some alarm bells. Then literally it was a case where my business colleague came across this presentation from Canada, and we went through this presentation, and it was all about a guy, I think, who had read Mary Elizabeth Croft,
yeah,
gone into court on a tax issue, and when asked, you know, are you Mr. Smith, he just literally responded, which one, to which the judge dismissed the case.
Cracking. That's a cracking answer, isn't it? Which
absolutely
one?
Yeah. Nice, short and sweet. Yeah, that's a short and sweet remedy to that one. And so that really, as a result of that, he then went on to, you know, film this presentation because he decided that he'd research what had actually happened. He wasn't sure himself what had actually taken place there and why. And then came across this thing called The Person, which obviously a lot of people are getting into and becoming familiar with, so I won't bore everyone with that now. But and I saw that for myself. And when I kind of saw that, you know, the definition of the word, and it took, you know, a good fair period of time to process, although I understood it for what it meant, I didn't understand what it meant in the wider context, and the implications at large, and just how big this thing was. And that takes some getting used to. That's pretty scary to come to terms with, and it was for me.
Yes.
I don't mind saying that, you know, the moment I realised what the implications could be of attempting to uphold the truth, I physically shook and cried. And, you know, and that itself, you know, actually, you know, I asked myself the question, well, you know, do you kind of ignore this, or do you go with it and, you know, really uphold what is correct?
And in the end, what choice do we have, eh?
At the moment I asked myself the question, I knew the answer.
Yeah.
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 So, hence, then, you know, expanding that that research, or going on from that, I was fortunate enough for mother to allow me my inheritance on a kind of monthly basis, pre her departing this mortal plane, and she supported me for 2 years, and I just spent 14 hours a day researching this, sucking
right,
it all up.
Right, you've actually, now that's one of the, that's partly explains the quality of your presentations, if you've had the time right to do the full time, because
yeah,
of course many people are just doing it sort of in the dead of night, aren't they, when the children are in bed, or when all other duties have been seen to.
Yeah.
That's really good. That explains to me the, you know, the quality, the density of the knowledge that appears to be in that head of yours.
Well, thank you.
So, and 10 out of 10 to your mum, I guess. You must have had a bit of an extra urge, though, because to a certain extent you'd actually been applying all this stuff to people in your time in banking, hadn't you, really?
Yeah,
I mean, unknowingly doing them over, really.
Well, yeah, I used to I used to approve the loans, you know, used to manage the team, and funny enough, I used to go and collect the loans again, or collect them back if people didn't pay. So, you know, in terms of the training, and you know, I appreciate that when people wake up to this, you know, they are being kept busy with busyness,
yes.
And there's a reason for that, so that you are too tired to get involved in some of these kind of areas of research.
And you can't afford, because of the business and you're being tied into it, you can't actually afford to believe that what we've discovered to be true is true, can you? Because you...
Well, absolutely. You know, they cannot allow you to find this stuff out.
No.
Because ultimately, when you find out what's actually being perpetrated, and, you know, the system itself isn't necessarily such a bad thing, but when you understand how it should operate and the way that it is being operated, it's absolute craziness. Because... You know, everything can run so much smoother. I mean, it almost refers us all to a kind of non-law-based question, which is, you know, just looking around us, are we seriously saying that, you know, we can split atoms, we can do X, Y, Z, and yet we can't actually organise, you know, for want of a better word, a piss up in a brewery?
Yeah.
And just use common sense in terms of, you know, allowing everyone to eat and have shelter and,
yeah.
And, you know, and live fantastic lives. That's what it's supposed to be about. But we've elected to go down this route where we're in competition with each other.
Yeah.
And we've allowed ourselves to be, as far as I'm concerned, completely and utterly ripped off.
Yes, yeah, yeah, that seems to be absolutely, under, you know, to a huge and quite remarkable extent.
To an unbelievable extent, and it is unbelievable.
So you spent a couple of years reading.
Educating myself, yeah. So, yeah, the research, have I unearthed something brand new? No, I haven't. Not at all. You know, I'm not the first to find this stuff. There have been many, many people that have you know, uncovered the true way of operating and uncovered the way in which, you know, certain other parties are already operating and have been for many hundreds of years. What we're now doing is educating ourselves,
yeah.
And then effectively saying, well, that's fine, you know, now you must recognise, we know the game that's going on. You've got to recognise that we can play that game too.
Yeah.
And if not, then what we've got is no fair kind of organised method of engaging in commerce, you know, a la society.
Yeah.
Because that's what it is, it's a society of commerce.
Yes, yes indeed. So what was your first move when you came out of the library and finished pencil marking up all the little books?
Well, at the time I was actually, or should I say my straw party was, shall we, yeah, in debt, shall we say.
Yeah, okay.
In debt, allegedly in debt. And so it was a case whereby, you know, back was up against the wall anyway. There was no way of effecting payment in the old-fashioned world of fiction. And so, literally, they were my kind of projects to start off with,
yes.
You know, and
yes.
They're live projects. Not necessarily the best way of doing it. Lots of things done that I would do differently now, with additional education under my belt. But it was an experience, and it's an experience which, for me, over time, over repeated times of going into court and then, you know, understanding more of the game that's being played, it was really a fear-removing kind of process,
yeah.
Because that one of the big things that stops anyone from getting involved with this or wanting to look is A, the scariness of it and the fear and fright that might bring, but also the fear in even challenging or asking an alleged authority, you know, a question or saying, well, hold on, are you sure that that's correct? And people are so scared of everything nowadays, they've forgotten, you know, if you want to call it a God-given right, your birthright, whatever you want to call it, your unalienable right.
Your duty.
Yeah, your duty to actually stand up for your fellow man when you see that wrong's being perpetrated.
And to ask questions.
And to ask questions.
What we're here for.
Because these people, this alleged authority, ultimately is supposed to work for us.
Yes.
We are the authority.
Yes.
You know?
Yes.
People have forgotten. Why go cap in hand asking for things? Not saying to take, but ultimately, when people understand the way that things and the system should be operating, well then ultimately they would understand that, yeah, it would lead to then take because everything is prepaid.
Well, that's right.
Prepaid.
One of the most common questions I'm asked by more conservative people to whom I speak is, so you don't think you ought to pay for services?
Well, I can't pay.
No.
In the current system because everything is a promise to pay.
Yeah.
There is no substance, nothing can be paid. That's the first thing people have got to understand. And then, you know, secondly, I appreciate that there is a whole commercial system out there and it's operating on an exchange basis at the moment with this medium of exchange called money. And for many, they would say, well, if you don't have to effect payment or hand over some piece of paper, what's going to happen? Right, what's going to happen? Is everything going to collapse? Well, there's no reason for everything to collapse because there's common sense and mutual reliance that comes into play here, in as much as, you know, we're all operating in one particular way, the way that we've been taught to operate. And so I can't see everyone, even from a common sense point of view, downing tools overnight. In fact, I can't see everyone overnight suddenly becoming awake to this and educating themselves to a level where they would then question what they're doing. It's a very slow process. It will automatically, as far as I'm concerned, bring on board very slow change. Okay, because when you see it for what it is, you don't want to be part of it, or certainly I don't, and no one I know does, once they've woken up to it.
It makes you feel like, well, it made me feel like a criminal. I felt culpable. Because you're participating in robbery,
yeah.
And B, all of the money here, anyway, in this country, most of it goes into this general consolidated fund for the fighting of war.
Yeah. Well, we've been complicit in fraud, murder and everything. Alleged murder, shall I say.
Yeah.
Yeah? And alleged fraud.
Yes.
We've been aiding and abetting, really, through want of ignorance.
Yeah.
And, it's just crazy. It's sickening when you kind of wake up to it, and you have to go through all these different levels of acceptance in terms of the fact that, you know, ultimately we've been to blame for this ourselves.
Yeah.
We have. However, everything is correctable.
Yes.
And we can make amends for those mistakes. And it's purely, first and foremost, to wake up. That's the first step, is to actually acknowledge that there's something not quite right, and then see what the system actually applies to.
Yes.
And once we wake up to that, then it's for people to, you know, search their hearts and follow the path they've got a path in, whichever small or big way they want to do it. Knowing is enough.
Yes, that's right. Yeah, your attitude, your sovereign attitude, and the knowledge you've got on board. So those first court cases, they were on your behalf, presumably.
On my own behalf.
For other people.
Yeah, on my own behalf.
And has it all been like that, or have you been?
Well, I say that for the first one. In fact, the first one, sorry, just to correct there, the first, very first one was that one case I mentioned about the client.
Right, yes,
and,
yes.
And that was the case where, there were a couple of things that I did there. I bonded that claim.
Which means?
I created a bond,
yeah,
as a man, and I bonded the case. I bonded my, the actual claim that was being made against the company that I was operating,
yeah,
through at the time. And also, whilst in...
So what is a bond, just for people that don't know? What's its function?
Well, you can look at a bond in a couple of different ways. You can look at it in the way that it's an insurance policy, all right? You're saying, well, if X, Y, Z happens, okay, I'll insure that. In other words, if what I'm saying in this claim or this case is incorrect, then I will bond you, I will insure that. Here is a remedy for you. Here's like your damages that I'm putting up for you to take. But by the same token, if you can't prove your claim, then you owe me that money.
Okay. Right? So at the moment, people are buying government bonds.
Right.
In a response to the bailing out of the banks, aren't they? As far as I gather, I'll get back to your story,
yeah,
in a minute, but it's just occurred to me that I've heard that the, if you like, the, whatever the credit side, the debit side is on, or credit, whichever side it is, if this is, you know, the bank crashing and loads of money being poured in, that the result of that is the buying of a whole load of government bonds.
Well, government bonds, slightly different from the bond I'm talking about in that case, but a government bond, as I understand it, is literally, you know, it's that guarantee of repayment for borrowing some funds. Okay, so they'll borrow the funds, whether it's from the market, which ultimately would be the privately owned banks.
So we've got a financial bond and a legal bond, effectively,
and,
haven't we?
Yeah, and
bond in law.
The bond that the government's offering up, in effect, it is still a guarantee or an insurance policy, and we are backing that with our labour. So it's our labour which will back that.
Yeah.
So, you know, hence that thing that I tend to refer to in some of the talks that I do, in the seminars that I hold. We are the security as such, yeah? We are the securities. And when the government issues these bonds, they're usually referred to as gilts,
yeah,
and therefore, you know, the system likes you to, also those that operate society like you, you know, like to stroke your ego and dangle the carrot and have you in fear and have you, of course, in guilt. and so we are the gilt-edged securities on
tempted,
that.
Tempted with the guilt.
Yeah, absolutely.
And guilty about it.
Absolutely. So, you know, and that's the way I like to draw the distinction right. to make this, what, okay. what's being perpetrated here so clear.
So let's return to your bond. You bonded, yeah. so you're basically saying, okay, if I'm right here, yeah. you're going to have to do this. If I'm wrong, I'm going to do this for you.
Absolutely.
Okay,
so I bonded that case, and then also the second thing happened when I went into court with my business partner, in as much as it was an expected railroading down at the local county court, you know, and perhaps wrong mindset, but I was expecting to kind of get railroaded. But we were going to have some fun, if you like, while we were there. And the judge gave an order for costs to be paid where the company had attempted to defend this client for 15 grand. So I literally, you know, confirmed that the judge was giving an order, accepted that order on condition he accept my bill, and gave him his £100 million bill, and then my £1 million fee schedule for turning up that day.
Yeah.
That case went away.
Right.
Now, whether it was that, or whether it was the bond,
okay,
or a combination of the both, but that certainly disappeared, and I know that that bond was queried, because the other side actually wrote to the Treasury where I'd lodged that bond to confirm and verify the validity of it, and the Treasury inadvertently returned that to me.
Isn't it funny how often that happens? That's a useful bit of information for you.
Yeah.
So just to slow down what happened there, the judge decided what precisely?
The judge decided that in attempting to defend these clients through the claims management company, that the claims management company that I was looking after was going to incur costs of £15,000.
Okay. Yeah.
And so at that hearing, he gave an order for costs.
Okay.
Sorry, an order for that £15,000 costs to be paid.
By?
Say within 14 days,
yeah,
I don't know what the precise period is.
Yeah, to be paid by you, by your company?
To be paid by the company.
By the company that was doing the defending.
Absolutely. So I as a man went in, because as a man, you know, you can actually go in on any party. This is something people have got to understand. We are sponsors, if you like, or sureties and securities for the entire system. All right? It all derives from us.
Yes.
So you can actually go and make moves on any company for its behalf, or on its behalf, if you like. You can actually effect payment on its behalf.
Well,
you
it can't do
it. You can defend it, because it cannot do it. It requires men and women to do it for it. So we can go in and do those things.
Okay, so you as a man recognised what the judge was doing,
mm-hmm.
In raising 15,000 costs against you trying to help your client.
Yeah.
And so as a man, you went in and...
I went in and I bonded that case, okay,
right.
as the man, on behalf of...
I see, so that's when the bonding happens.
That's when the bonding
happens.
So I did that as the man.
Yeah.
Okay, and then for my attendance, okay, because he was giving me an order, right, as a man, that's why he got his bill.
All orders being payable.
Yeah.
Because you have a scale of chances.
So he gave me an order. Now, well, it's a contract. It's a straightforward contract. So you can pick an amount that you deem appropriate. So I picked £100 million.
Okay. So he's trying to nobble you for 15 grand, and you come back at him for a million.
For £100 million.
For £100 million.
And then £1 million for turning up that day.
Okay.
Now, you know,
so £100 million's on the bond, and £1 million's for you turning up.
Well, there was £100 million on that my bill.
Okay. Right.
Okay. For accepting his order. There was £1 million on the fee schedule for turning up that day, and the bond of the whole case was for £500 million.
Okay, so that really gives them a little bit of jeopardy to chew over, does it not?
Well, it was raising the stakes, and
yeah.
This is the way we've got to look at it, because when you're going into court, you are playing a game, and by the pure virtue of the word court, that should, you know, make that quite clear to people. But the kind of game that you're playing is a kind of tennis game of words.
Yes.
Okay. And if you like, suggestion and argument. For one, I don't like to use.
No, that's it. It is. Yeah.
This is the kind of game that we're actually going to be playing within the court.
Yeah.
But it is with poker rules. All right, in terms of upping the ante, because you are raising the stakes each time.
And the poker face.
Yeah, and
as
you've
well.
Got to poker face, and you've got to call the bluff, and you don't let on what your hand is.
There's something about you.
Yeah, absolutely. There's got to be confidence, and that all assists with your playing of the game.
Yeah. So that one basically got turned over, and you're not really sure why, but it was ushered out of the door, and your client...
Well, the clients... The judge had even suggested in the very first hearing that we attended that the client should kick us two into touch and go and see the lovely solicitor that she had arranged outside for him. And the client, because of this kind of methodology that we were applying, you know, which was with knowledge of how the banks, or what the banks were doing with loans. I mean, it was very early doors for us in terms of our education, but we had an idea that was, we knew there was something not right going on. And so we were using those kind of arguments, and of course, I think the clients got a little bit jittery, bless them. So they elected to go with, funny enough, some solicitors, some friendly solicitors that we'd been in contact with that were actually in this kind of industry, claims management. And so I must admit, I don't know what actually happened with them.
Right, really interesting to have known, wouldn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. But it was really a case of, from that point onwards, things, you know, kind of spiralled in terms of, you know, the research, the reading, the educating ourselves, and then of course, you know, then taking on board all the other creditors.
Yeah.
So, but with regards to the creditors, I think I had about 13, or the straw party had about 13 accounts to deal with, and in dealing with them and practicing, you know, the method and style that I was, or the approach I was going to be using, you know, I think 9 of those actually ended up bugging out and, you know, gave up.
These were people to whom you nominally owed money.
Yeah, allegedly owed money. And then the others.
You're effectively at this stage still getting yourself out of.
I'm still learning.
Where you were also getting yourself out of the position you found yourself in as a result of macroeconomic manoeuvring.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely, and you know, certainly, in terms of this. I appreciate people look at it as getting themselves out of a position as such, but I really kind of look at it now that, you know, it's not even me in that position at all, you know. It's just this fictional game piece in this massive game, where we are bringing that to life with our energy. Our energy is worth everything. It's more valuable than gold. Right? More valuable than gold, because we're sentient. We can move around. Yeah. We're animated.
Yeah.
And we can do things. And that is the, you know, where the value actually lies. But we're playing this whole fictional game, which is being overseen by this thing called money, because money oversees and is embedded within every kind of trade that's going on. So money is overseeing it, and money has become king, and we end up chasing this thing, which was purely to enable trade to take place, just as a medium of exchange, just to, you know, mean that things can break down and be kind of measured, for want of a different word.
Well, it's a registering of promissory obligations.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, absolutely. But even just to, so that people could exchange things of different size, you know, a cow for a teacup, you know, so that there could be some kind of, you know, relationship built up there. But we've allowed this thing to be subverted and now become king, and especially now that it's all being printed as money as debt, that throws in a whole other dimension. But you know, we've lost sight of what it's all about, you know, and the ways that things can operate.
Yeah,
that's what we've lost sight of, and it's just really bringing people's attention to the fact that, look, you know, you're being had over here.
Yes.
Look at the reality of it all, and look at the fiction, and look at the words, and see what they mean. And then you tell me, with the benefit of that knowledge, what you feel in your heart as to what's right and what's wrong.
Yes, yeah, quite so. So you eventually managed, presumably, to deal with all of the creditors and the things that have come about as a result of your business in the business, as it were.
Yeah. I mean, I'm currently dealing with those via a bankruptcy.
Okay,
which I know there'll be people that are brand new to this, and they'll think, well, wow, he's gone into bankruptcy. No, I've not gone into anything.
No.
Okay, so Straw Party's gone into this alleged bankruptcy, although the Straw Party is already bankrupt.
Yeah.
As is the entire system, as is every corporation.
Mm.
Okay, so that's what people have got to understand. So this alleged bankruptcy thing, it's just another fiction. It's another game set to be played. And that's effectively frozen everything up. In fact, there's so many assets in that bankruptcy, it's unbelievable.
Assets
by way of commercial liens that I've issued against or recorded against various parties.
Yeah.
So that's freed up time for me, really, to have embarked, certainly, you know, on a kind of full-time basis.
Yeah.
In going out and educating and speaking to people. If they want me to come along and speak, then I go along and speak.
Which is really good. And also, you're with the White Rabbit organization, aren't you?
Yeah. So there's the White Rabbit Trust, and it's a whole conglomerate of educators that have come together.
Yeah.
And are doing their bit to help people through. Certainly, when people first start asking questions, it's to explain how things work. You know, and I certainly see my role as really just trying to conceptualise all the different ways that people can perceive this thing called the person, because it is multifaceted. It is difficult to get your head round when you first accept that this thing exists.
Yeah.
Sorry, or accept that it doesn't exist, whichever way you want to look at it.
Yeah.
But accept that this thing is being used with wordplay.
It came as a real surprise. I mean, once you've, well, I realised the fictional person thing and started getting, it's only recently that I've realised that there are other presentations of that fictional self. Mm. It's not just the you that's addressed, it's the driver, it's the occupier, it's the shopper, maybe, it's, I don't know, the client. It's all of those things, isn't it? All of those. Even weddings. It occurred to me, we were invited to a wedding recently, and I thought, hang on a moment, these are going to involve capital letters, signatures, date of birth, so the wedding is creating negotiable instruments, and then there's a registration as well, so there's something being given away there, and then suddenly that was for me, that was an explosion of the fictional person, of the straw man. You suddenly realise it's actually being applied all around you. It's like you've got a cloud of straw men rather than just one.
Yeah. Well,
which is presumably how the complexity of your wrapping up comes about.
Yeah, well, I mean, because I tried to think back at what it was that, kind of confused me.
Yeah.
Okay, because the greatest stumbling block for me was to actually conceptualize this thing called the person. It's not that I didn't get it straight away and I could see that, okay, yeah, it's a legal fiction and I know that it's not me because I'm a man. So, okay, I got that straight away. But it was letting it sink in, because it's the implications that come off the back of that. And then you've got another thing with regards to this perspective. There are different ways of looking at the same thing in law, in different law forms. And so, for me, having gone through lots and lots of reading, and that's, I'm not saying people don't have to do some reading, but what I try to do is paint the picture to explain the law concepts, okay, whether we look at this person as a license to engage in commerce, as a play piece in a game, as a mask, as a trust, as a probate estate, or whatever, whichever way we want to look at it, so that people can then really see it for what it is and see which potential games are being played on them when they're dealing with companies.
Yeah.
Okay. And it really does bring it home to you.
Yeah. Because we're saying that the person is actually treated different, say, by chancery law, by all the different sorts of law we've got as well.
Yeah.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, it can be construed in different ways, and its powers, because it will have powers at some point, at some time, because if construed as a beneficiary of a trust, it has fantastic power, and you're the master of that vessel.
Yeah, now we, of course, are supposedly the beneficiaries of our own trusts,
absolutely,
are we not?
Yeah.
And we are somehow being tricked out of that.
Absolutely.
Which I think could well be the main point of our conversation here, in fact.
Sure.
Is that particular...
Well, absolutely. I mean, let's go right back to the beginning. I mean, I don't know whether people ever kind of look around them and question, whether it could be done better. I mean, I did it growing up, and I looked at things around, but sometimes it's a case whereby, because of the way things are, you think, well, how could that ever be changed, right? Well, it has to start somewhere. But ultimately, if you just look at it as a whole, and you think, well, is this really the best way? Are we really, really saying this is the best way we can do things? Then take it back a stage further and think, well, okay, look, what's my position? What's my role in all of this? What is it that I'm supposed to be doing? Well, we were all given this planet, okay, to benefit from. If not, why are we here?
Yeah.
What's the point of being here, yeah? If we're not going to actually benefit from being here, then this whole journey, however you want to look at it, existence becomes kind of irrelevant and a complete waste of time. So there has to be some kind of purpose to it, and there has to be some kind of role that we have to perform. If we're supposed to benefit from this planet, then we're all equal as a fundamental, so therefore we will have an equal share.
Yes.
Now, we're forever being told at companies that, hey, there's no I in team, right? There's no I in team. You've got to be part of the team. You've got to work as a team. And yet, by its pure definition, companies are in competition with each other. Now, they then, that's then broken down. The people are then in competition with each other within a company, although they're supposed to work as a team.
Yes.
All right, so there's always going to be a conflict of interest there. Now, if we're taught to chase after this thing called money and compete with each other, and you tread on people to get what you want, or some people will, there's no real gearing up towards this cooperation thing. Well, if we've got, and in fact that's actually spouted as being required, competition's required in order to gain development and growth, I mean, I'd argue that point. I don't think that point makes much sense.
No, I've always been one for co-opetition myself.
Yeah.
Mixture between cooperation and competition is what's needed.
Absolutely, and that's borne out by just even my involvement in terms of, you know, meeting with people that are, you know, kind of like-minded and have seen the things for what they are, or even in, you know, my studies and being educated by other people. And the amount that can be achieved by a few people that work together is unbelievable. It's just, it's absolutely outstanding from what I've seen firsthand. And so all this kind of, you know, gearing up towards competing with each other rather than getting along, like assisting each other, cooperating for the common good, and then having more me time,
yes,
you know, and more us time, and time to actually, you know, discuss these things and talk about whatever you want and do whatever you want and follow your heart and follow your hobby.
I think both you and I have a lot more time than we used to have. I used to be a 50, 60, 70, 80 hour a week man as well for money. And I know then when I was doing that, I had very little time. I wasn't getting proper sleep, I wasn't getting proper food or proper holidays or actually any time to do what we're doing here.
Mm.
And when I did sit and talk about things, it was just passing the time of day. We weren't, you know, actually getting to the meat of the issue.
Yeah.
So I think already the Freeman movement or the freedom movement, the sovereignty movement, whatever we want to call it, is already benefiting. I mean, we saw yesterday, didn't we, have a fantastic chat around the table in the sort of crew canteen.
Yeah.
There's half a dozen, what we might loosely call rebellious souls there, sharing. Really sharing, and it was very difficult to tear ourselves away from the conversation.
Well, no, because it gets so interesting, and it's, you know, I learn every day.
Yes.
You know, I don't know everything. I really don't.
No.
And, you know, I certainly don't know everything about, you know, my own kind of preferred subject matter, you know, and I find that out every day.
Yeah.
Because there is so much to learn, there's so many different perspectives, but with each perspective, you know, you gain more knowledge and you gain a deeper understanding.
Yeah.
And the feeling of empowerment that gives you, well, it just can't be described. It really cannot. But ultimately, we've all got a job to do here.
Yeah.
And let's work together for the common good.
So, and I think that one of the things that moves us on most quickly is firstly possibly recognising the successes that others have, and then making our own little successes.
Mm.
So you had your first success, well, whatever, the client wandered off and the case was lost, but I mean, or moved away, shall we say.
Yeah, never heard about it. Yeah.
What would you say was the first thing that you did that you could look at and go, well, that worked well?
Well, I think, I mean, again, I don't know particularly because, I, you know, whether it was the bonding of the case or whether it was, or the bonds then backed up with the fact that I'd got this judge into contract. All I know is I never heard about that again.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So that in itself is a success. And for within this game, all right, people have to look at how a success is defined, because for many, it's a case of if they're left alone and get some peace and quiet and don't have these kind of, you know, wolves at the door, then that is in itself a success. You're never gonna get, because some people do ask this and inquire about this, but you're never gonna get, you know, those that are kind of perpetrating this stuff openly admitting, you know, what they've done. But by the same token, the words and the definitions of the words are in the public domain. It's all there for people to just go and look at. You know, the greatest thing that's assisted this is, yes, our ignorance, but it's been a distracted ignorance. You know, we've been distracted away from things like boring politics and boring law and boring issues of that nature. And you don't want to get involved in managing the planet. You know, we've got a great team of guys that have got no experience in this area at all to do that job. You know, and can be fantastically well paid and treated like, you know, Z-list celebrities or whatever. It's, you know, and that's what we've gone for, because it's too easy to let someone else do it.
Yes.
And yet it's, from what I've witnessed and what I've been involved with, it's far more exciting and enjoyable and fun, you know, and you can have a great time actually doing as opposed to abdicating that responsibility.
Yes, I quite agree. And the first bit, because as you know, I've been dealing with people who are with some bailiffs recently, and the first time you encounter them, your heartbeat goes up, and it's like you're dealing with somebody who's not a human.
Yeah.
And once you have dealt with them as the man, you know, talking to the man, not the uniform or what have you, you get calmer, it gets easier, does it not?
Yeah, absolutely.
And it is a lot more fun than just handing over the money, that has to be said. I think also it's important to realise, isn't it, that as we're educating ourselves, when we interact with these people, we need to realise that we're educating them as well.
Absolutely. I see every contact. Let me take that back. I used to see every contact with, as you say, an adrenaline rush. You know, and it's important that people get that, because all that's doing, you know, the adrenaline's kicking in to heighten your senses, which is welcome. But then obviously that fight or flight bit gets to the pit of your gut, and that's the bit that's not welcome. So you have to release that bit and keep the brain bit, so you keep your senses about you. And, you know, if anything, that trained me to do that, to learn how to do that. But it's only by repeatedly facing that fear that you have the ability to then, you know, become used to it. It's all practice. But absolutely, you have to talk to the man. Yeah. You have to talk to them and treat them almost like, especially if they are still asleep to this, you've got to treat them like a child. Now, I didn't at first, you know, I'll be completely hands up. I went into battle mode, you know, a lot of the time. But certainly now that I've learned to control that, or at least as far as I'm concerned, control that, every contact is an education for them.
Yeah.
You know, that's the way I see it. So if they want to come talk, that's fine, but I will be educating them.
Yes, yeah.
And that's the way I look at it.
I think there's another point in there. It's a point that Vin makes on from TNS Radio. He says that it's possibly what we don't want to do is corner them. We don't want to be cornered. Mm. They don't want to be cornered.
No, absolutely.
So it's more like a kind of dance. And like you say, if in the end they leave you alone, and they give you the opportunity, obviously, as a result, to leave them alone,
yeah,
then that's good enough, is it not? Yeah. Was it you that was telling us yesterday about something that had been drawn to a close, and then the client decided to have a poke?
Yeah. It's, you know, sometimes, I'll speak generically on this one,
yeah,
but sometimes it's, you know, I think it's better, we all want closure to some of these issues, and we all want reassurance, because that's been built up in us with this fear thing, you know, i.e. that you're always worrying about the unknown thing that's going to come around the corner, or what could happen. Now, by the very nature of that fear, or that mind process, we always think of that which is the worst thing that could happen, okay, and then that plays on our minds. In a lot of these kind of situations, or skirmish being another word for situations, so in a lot of these situations that come up with these exchange of letters from various companies, there may come times when they just back off. Now, that's a success, but a lot of the time, you know, we have to learn to not necessarily go in and seek that reassurance that they're going to back off, and we want them to put their hands up and say, yeah, we got it wrong, and blah, 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 blah. Sometimes we have to be happy and content with actually just say, fine, well, I would leave that alone now. Because it can, you know, work, and I've done it myself, where you then go back to the company, you seek some reassurance, and it wakes them back up again, and off they go again, you know, because,
yes,
and they think that they're up for a game again. Now, you know, what's actually going on place a lot of the time, certainly with say, the banks or the business societies, or finance companies, is that it's just their collections department. You know, it's having worked the other side of the coin. All they'll do is, you know, they get a queue of accounts to work each day, and they've got targets. They've got to collect so much, or so many accounts have got to pay a full payment each month. And so they've got their targets, and that's all they'll see. And so if you then write in, I remember if we used to have accounts that went kind of quiet, you know, once they'd gone three or four payments into arrear, all right, you're then getting to the stage where effectively the bank has quite written that off as a debt. They've allowed that to become a bad debt. When you get to, say, month six, the chances are that's already been written off against their profit. And so every pound they collect is pure profit. But it does mean that their focus is going to be on the new accounts that are going into arrear. All right, so a lot of the time, once it's got past, say, 6 months of non-payment, the chances are they may well just leave that. Or people will find they'll pass that out to a debt collector, because the bank will think, well, we're not going to waste our time on that. Our time's far more valuable than a debt collector. So what we'll do is we'll sell that on or pass that out to a debt collector. Now, I know that Get Out of Debt Free has got some fantastic, you know, gamesmanship and template, or, like, you know, suggested wordings or approach to dealing with accounts that have been sold to debt collectors. In as much as if a debt collector wants to pay off your loan, brilliant, thank you.
Yes, he's stepped in and saved you the trouble.
Absolutely, but you don't necessarily have a contract with him.
Certainly don't, I wouldn't have thought.
So there's a lovely angle to play, but, you know, the people, what I'm getting at is that the people and the system itself that's operated from the bank will be pretty much automated. If they get a letter in, they're going to chase it up, because someone's made contact. They might be able to get them to pay, because I need to hit my targets this month to get my bonus.
They need to have an interest, otherwise they wouldn't have got in touch.
Absolutely. Yeah. And so, you know, by prodding the monster, as it were, you wake them up.
Yeah.
And so sometimes it's better to let those things lie.
I think on that sort of point, that actually has just brought to mind that you're kind of... some of the self-defense techniques. And I remember I was trained in one called Aikido, which is your pacifist self-defense. You can't use it to attack anybody. You need the weight of the other person to be coming towards you.
Yeah.
And you simply step to one side and just lean. And it's their energy that takes them down.
Yeah.
So again, what we're saying here perhaps is that really you need to leave them to come for you and you're the responder.
Yeah, I mean, you know, certainly get yourself into a position where you are, for want of a better word, you're tooled up with your commercial tools, your commercial defences. Right?
What would you say the basic commercial defences are that you've come across in your...
Well, in effect, it's establishing, and I don't like to use the word facts, but it's establishing the facts. You know, because we could agree that the sky is purple with yellow, you know, diagonal lines across it. I'm not referring to chemtrails, but we could say that. And if we both agree on it, then in this court where we're sitting now, that would be a fact. So I don't like the word facts, but I'll use it anyway.
But the circumstances as perceived.
Yes, as can be agreed between the parties.
Yeah,
so
okay.
So it's important to gain an agreement between you and the other party as to what's actually happened. Now, if you know that they've been up to some skullduggery with regards to the loan document, for example, or how they financed this alleged loan, then you can establish that from your own jurisdiction. Now, we each are our own jurisdiction. When we swear an affidavit with two witnesses, we become a tribunal, our own tribunal, our own tribune, okay? And we are therefore, you know, our court, because we each have the ability to disseminate information and make a judgment call on something, so therefore we are our own judge. So we're our own court and our own judge, and we can make a decision on something. Now that's by giving fair and due notice to the other side to say, hey, look, you know, or from whichever way you want to approach it, this is what's gone on, all right? Now if that's not what's gone on, then you rebut that and you prove that wrong, all right?
So that's a notice. That's a notice.
Yeah, a notice
of understanding.
Yeah. And however you can do it, notice of understanding, or you can do it a case of, you know, I want some reassurance that you've actually kept your side of the bargain, because, you know, it's my understanding that you were going to lend me something that you had. Right? So I want proof that you lent me something that you had, because my research seems to suggest that you didn't lend me anything that you had.
You just pulled it out of thin air.
You pulled it out of thin air. And in fact, I gave you what I had. I'm the one that made the loan of my energy, you know, to give credence and credibility to everything that you're doing. And so you can start this process off in any way, but in effect, what you're looking at is you're looking at a set of three affidavits over, you know, whether it's 30-day breaks, whether it's 10-day breaks, and if you're pushed for time, 3-day breaks.
Okay? So that's
to establish establish what's gone on.
Yeah.
And then, you know, if they do not come back at you, and the chances are they won't, because you swear your affidavit with unlimited commercial liability.
And also it's not rebuttable.
And it's not rebuttable because it's true. Because it's true.
Yeah.
So, you know, when they are literally, the light of truth is cast upon them or whatever, they literally cannot respond to it. They can't, and they will not step from behind that mask of limited liability to come out and go toe-to-toe with you. None of them will. And so you then establish that decision. The decision has been made, right? You sometimes hear things like, you know, estoppel, that means you can't come through there, you're barred by estoppel, or it's just a case of, look, this is a foreign jurisdiction judgment, I've made my judgment. That judgment is then enforceable in that UK jurisdiction, all right? And, you know, we need to believe in the power of those three documents. So you've got three documents, each with three signatures on, you know, and nine's a magic number.
Which is effectively your notice, or whatever, your this is how it is, and then you say...
A notice of fault and opportunity.
Yeah, I haven't heard from you,
so
this is another
what's going on.
Yeah. And then you have not.
You've not come back to me, default, that's the judgment, that's it, I've made my decision. I've given you ample opportunity to answer these questions or to come out and prove this wrong.
Yeah.
You've not done that, therefore you agree.
And the main difference here, as far as I'm concerned, with the notices that I've heard about and that I've been doing, is that you're after another couple of signatures as well as your own.
Yeah, so, you know, a lot of people will talk about notaries and so on and so forth, and yeah, fine, you know, the notary public is an officer of the court, it will get recognised in their jurisdiction. Yeah, cool. My experience has been that, you know, a lot of these things, certainly at county court level, were being just kicked out and ignored. you can't force someone that doesn't want to play the game honourably to play it honourably. Now, you know,
and the notaries are in the other side of the game, really, aren't they? Now, not happy about cooperating necessarily.
Absolutely. Now, some of what I've witnessed firsthand, you know, I would not say is honourable. I mean, it's downright lying and so on and so forth. But you could view it that if they make the suggestion that something's true, again, as that example I gave earlier, if they're kind of making the suggestion or stating for truth that, hey, you know, the sky is purple with yellow slashes, and I then don't play my part and deny that or rebut that, then I've just agreed with that, which makes that a fact within the de facto court.
So that's just by acquiescence.
So perhaps they're just playing the game better than I am when I've been in there. But it certainly didn't feel honourable to me.
The point there is that you can buy acquiescence by doing nothing. Yeah. You're also approving that.
Yeah,
which is what they're doing, in all fairness, which when they don't respond to your letters.
They do it to us, or the straw party, and we can then do it to them as men and women. So you establish those facts, and that then gives you power, but you've got to believe in that. You've got to believe wholeheartedly that, look, you know, let's look at this from a common sense point of view. How many times have I got to ask someone, you know, when I found out that they've had their hand in the cookie jar, how many times have I really got to give them the opportunity to come forward and either admit it if I've got the actual proof there, or to answer simple questions about how things work to clarify they haven't done something wrong? And when, you know, when these places just do not answer, I mean, it says it all, okay? And all they'll do is they'll then just get really heavy with you. Well, you know, that's just blatant as to what's going on there. If we were watching a film or a drama and seeing this unfold, people would be saying, well, why doesn't he do this? Why doesn't he do that? Well, why don't we do this? And why don't we do that? Because, you know, if we don't stand up for ourselves and actually, you know, nip this in the bud and say, right, okay, we know what's going on, this is where it stops, I've got a foreign jurisdiction judgment, you know, butt out. Right, I'm not playing this game with you anymore. Yeah.
Yeah.
You're wasting my time.
Yeah.
And that's what we can do to actually get in there quickly.
So
and then you can actually, you know, defend yourself.
Yeah.
With any actions.
So, because obviously, as we know, quite often what happens when you put in these three things is that the stuff just gets rubber stamped through the court anyway, and you end up with liability orders and all of that. So let's just put a sort of theoretical thing together where somebody's done that, say to the council, say for council tax, they said, look, prove to me that I owe this to you.
Yeah.
You know, prove that you know what the difference between the person and the whatever.
Yeah.
And then you said, I'm giving you another 10 days and you haven't done that.
Right.
And what they've done then is they've rubber stamped the whole thing, they've set out a load of, you know, liability orders.
Yeah.
You've maybe got a scale of charges for every return letter, so they maybe technically owe you £1,500 already.
Yep.
Then they hand it over to bailiffs, and you've told the bailiffs not to trespass, and you've offered them a £4,950 fine, you know, payment every time they come up. So you're in this position, say the person's in a position where they've done all of this stuff, and obviously the bailiffs are still coming.
Right.
How could you convert all of that stuff that they're paying no attention to into something that they really
they
do have to? Because obviously, in that process, they have done loads and loads of things that are outside their own due process.
Absolutely, absolutely. And I'll run through them now. I mean, if necessarily, obviously, not to be construed as legal advice in any way, shape or form, but this is what I would do if I were in that set of circumstances. So, you've established the facts with the council that there is no bill payable.
And lawful estoppel has been
acquired and established, and in effect you've got foreign jurisdiction judgment. Now, if they try to take you to a magistrate's, well, I think it's fairly, you know, it's quite commonplace information and knowledge now that what the council is actually doing is renting out a room at the magistrate's, and they're filling it with their own staff. Well, that's a breach of their own rules under the Human Rights Act, Article 47 of the Human Rights. Which actually states that, you know, you should have an independent tribunal. Well, it's not independent if the council are acting as prosecutor and judge. And it could be argued that it's not independent if you go into a court like that, but, you know, any HMCS court anyway, because the judge is most likely receiving some kind of commercial reward.
And quite often it's not a tribunal either.
Yeah, so
it's only one of them.
Absolutely. So, you know, is it going to be independent anyway? One would have to say perhaps no.
Perhaps.
But, so you're in this court, so that's misrepresentation as far as I'm concerned. And anyone who wants to read the misrepresentation of 1967, you may well find that, you know, you might want to go down that kind of avenue. Again, if they were to go straight to bailiffs, well then they've denied you your right to a day in court. So that's a breach of 1689 Bill of Rights. Okay, any you know, fine or forfeiture before a day in court is null and void, it's illegal. Okay, so that's a line to follow there. But if it then comes down to, you know, you having to then go into court and play this game or have to present this, you can then maybe approach it from a couple of different angles, and these are the angles I would be considering if it was myself. So either having obtained this foreign jurisdiction judgment, you have the right to then deny them jurisdiction. Now, I phoned up the National Legal Helpline, and they were quite helpful. And they put me onto a solicitor, who then said, well, if you have a foreign jurisdiction judgment and you want to bar them from proceeding, you do a form N244, an application form, and you file it in with a petition. Now, I see it's a self-styled, you're stating that your court has given the decision, that this has already been decided upon, right? And then, in effect, I think it's the use of square brackets, you're asking for their court to acknowledge that and recognise that, and I believe that would be under the De La Haye Convention. Alright? Because there's a treaty of recognising foreign jurisdiction judgments. So that's the way of actually then barring them from proceeding against you. Alternatively, you could view this that if they're attempting to enforce legal jurisdiction over a man, so in other words, you know, they've had three affidavits from you. They know that it says the words flesh and blood man. Now, if their staff cannot distinguish between what's called a legal fiction and a flesh and blood man, then they're in the wrong jobs, and we're paying someone that doesn't know what they're doing, so they're incompetent. But the mere fact that, in point of fact, you'll actually have probably a head of legal services who's responsible for all this, and they will probably be a barrister or a solicitor. So they know the score. I've spoken with first year law students, and one of the first things they get taught is this legal personality. They know all about it, okay? Whether they look at it in the right context is another matter. Whether they're not seeing the wood for the trees and they just think it's, you know, part of the overall scheme of things, I don't know. But they do know about it. So there are limitations of that jurisdiction, and we just have to spell it out to them. But so again, I would then be looking at if the council is then trying to, having been served three pieces of paper which clearly spell out who and what you are, they still attempt to enforce that. Okay, as far as I'm concerned, they are either incompetent and unfit to hold office because they cannot read, or they are willfully attempting to enforce legal jurisdiction over a man. And that is a common law offence. Common law, as far as I'm concerned, is the true criminal law. Now, I've spoken to the SRA, Solicitors Regulation Authority, and I spoke to their Fraud Investigations and Intelligence Department, and they confirmed categorically that if a solicitor attempts to enforce legal jurisdiction over a man, that is an offence which they would investigate, okay, with potential being kicked, or the potential to be kicked off the Law Society's register. Now, I think that's cool, but secondly, if found guilty of that via their own tribunal, that solicitor would then face criminal prosecutions from the Solicitors Regulation Authority itself. But an interesting second thought with that is that, let's say you've got Solicitor Joe Bloggs and you've got Solicitor Bill Brown, and Bill Brown's a naughty boy, and he's attempting to enforce false legal jurisdiction over a man. You can go to Joe, bring that to his attention, and Joe must act. Because if Joe doesn't act according to the Solicitors Regulation Authority's own rules, then Joe's also guilty, prima facie. So I was hypothesising the other day, thinking that, well, for most of these actions that we get coming through, where we have sent off affidavits, and it spells out that you're a man or a woman, the next letter back is the prima facie evidence of what they're trying to do. Is it not? Therefore, how would it be if you took that along to any old solicitor in town, or maybe five or six of them, and showed them and say, hey, I want a free consultation. You go in for your free consultation and you explain what's happened, and you get them to read that you're a flesh and blood man or woman, and they even admit that they're not talking to a legal fiction, they're talking to a man or woman. They are duty bound to then do something about it. You see, solicitors want all the controversy, and so do the barristers. And the way I look at it is that we're just giving them what they want. It's just that controversy is now going to be amongst themselves. So let them fight amongst themselves. Let them have to grass each other up. Let them have to act against each other.
And this also is another important part of what we're doing, is actually tying up these people, costing them time and money, doing things other than us.
Well, absolutely, if that's what they want. I mean, you know, they're generating all this kind of money off the back end of that anyway with these bonds and so on and so forth, so let them go do that. But, you know, if people are aware of this, I appreciate that a lot of people at the moment are potentially asleep and on autopilot, and for them, you know, the system, well, not the system, that's the wrong word, for them the current, you know, the status quo at the moment and the way that things are is their support, and you know, their safety cushion, if you like. And so you can't just whip that from under them. You know, it will take time for people to wake up, but certainly once you're awake to this, you know, if they know you're awake, they've got to recognise it. If they won't recognise it and they're still attempting to play games, then we've got to force them to recognise it. And then we need to then, you know, look very carefully at whether or not honour is going to come into this. Because if, when someone's awake, they're awake. There's no going back.
No.
You cannot, certainly my experience, I mean, you can't look at things the old way. You can maybe play games the old way, but you can't, you cannot ever look at anything the same way
again. It's a choice. If you want the blue pill, you eat the blue pill. Once you've eaten the red one, the blue pill won't do the job anymore.
Absolutely. Yeah. So, you know, so when we wonder why things don't work, well, you know, look, take the pill. You know, open up to, and see it, and you'll see it for what it is. And it is so simple and so blatantly in your face. You know, as to why things don't work and why things are not harmonious.
Yes.
And it's right in front of us, and it is amazing to wake up to it. The process of waking up to it is, you know, like the greatest journey or trip, for want of a better word, that you're ever going to have. It's just enlightening.
Well, I think there's a feeling, I mean, certainly in me, that we've been waiting for that moment. I mean, I you know, in our house, we've always had a problem with Mr. and Mrs. Mess on forms. We've always had a problem with that. We've never liked it and have been trying to get away without filling it in. And it's like there's bits of you that already know. You feel that all the work that I've been saying for years, I've been going, this is wrong. They should be paying us tax for what we're doing.
Yeah.
It surely should be that way around. And it's almost like our generation, and in fairness, people have been working at this for 20 or 30 years before us, haven't they?
Otherwise, yeah,
otherwise we wouldn't have the kind of critical mass that we're gathering now.
You know, hats off to those people, because they would have been, you know, in possibly, you know, more scary places than us. At least we've got people we can liaise with and talk to, and you know you're not alone.
And we've got slightly firmer ground on, you know, it was all quicksand as far as they were concerned.
Absolutely.
Wasn't it? Talking of which, I mean, have you in your activities actually copped for any damages or a hit or anything from the system as a result of you?
Well, in terms of anything negative?
Anything negative?
No, not at all. I mean, don't get me wrong, you know, I've had bailiffs knock at the door and stuff like that in the usual kind of interplay that, you know, that inevitably takes place with some of these things. But I've had nothing horrible happen to me.
No.
Or not that I would describe as horrible. And for the large part, I mean, don't get me wrong, I used to be quite forward about going in and asking questions down at the local police station, the council, and I'll go in there and ask questions because, you know, they're supposed to answer.
Yeah.
So I was quite upfront about going in and asking stuff, and so maybe they find me more of a harassment than, you know, or a pain in the backside than they could potentially put on me. But no, I've been quite fortunate. I don't think, you know, I think if you kind of manifest that or expect that to happen, then it's something that's going to play with your fear, and you might bring that on yourself. So I tend not to even consider it.
Yeah, I think that's a very important thing. We've touched on attitude a couple of times, and it really is knowing that you're sovereign is the first thing, and then finding out all the rest afterwards.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's just so hard to put into words sometimes as to the stance that, you know, certainly that it's kind of perpetuated in me, but, you know, we are responsible for everything. We are ultimately responsible for everything. So if we do not stand up, then who's going to do it?
Absolutely.
Okay. Who's going to do it? Well, there's no one to do it. You know, I sometimes describe it as, you know, you're living in a small village and there's this huge army coming down towards you, ready to just, like, you know, annihilate you all. Do you just, you know, tuck tail and run and get caught anyway? Or do you stand there and at least try to do something about it?
Yeah.
Well, you know, I know what my option was.
Yeah.
You know? Yeah. To emphasise the point, it's not something that we should be looking at fighting against, but more redirecting the energy flow, as you said with your, you know, the martial arts and stuff.
Yeah.
You know, let's turn their energy into good energy and show up what they're doing. Because a lot of the time, as you say, or as you mentioned earlier, they are breaking their own processes, they're breaking this, so we are educating them.
And only some of them are aware of that.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm thinking that the entire court system must be full of people, 8, 9 out of 10 of them, who've got no idea about this at all.
Well,
no idea even about who they're working for.
Absolutely, I've got no doubt that a lot of the staff are not going to necessarily be interested in, you know, I mean, I've worked with plenty of people, and, you know, and you do get people, there's nothing wrong with that, but, you know, they're just not interested in that. So they pay no attention, but there are plenty of staff in there that do know that something's not right. And I've spoken to enough court staff, very friendly, you know, I've spoken to some very unfriendly ones as well, but I've spoken to enough friendly staff to know that they know something's up. But a lot of the time, you know, the answer is, well, look, you know, I've got to do a job somewhere, you know, and okay, you know, it's not necessarily what I want to do, but I've got to do my job.
Yeah, but so this is another point that we need to make to people, is that many of us, excuse me, many of us must surely find ourselves in positions where we sort of, because of the state of mind we're in, we can't afford to believe that the things are opposite from the way they appear to be. Yeah. So there's almost got to be an internal step to one side for some people. If you are, say, a policeman or working in the court service or, say, in the county council or in more or less any form of government, you've got to realise that before you can even start to think about it, you might need to take a step out of your own mindset somehow.
Yeah. Well, for those that have woken up and know that there's something going down, and from you know, however rounded that view is, and you know, I'm not saying mine's a rounded view, you know, I've got plenty to learn still, I really have, but I see it for what it is. I certainly see that. And you could, you know, for example, look at things that take place certainly on a commercial basis at large, and it, you know, and if we leave things unchecked, then there are avenues that this whole system can go down, which are not necessarily the best kind of outcome I would ever want to imagine. So there's only one way of ensuring that things go the right way, and that everything kind of works out well in the end of this fairy tale, you know, and that is to potentially do something about it. For a lot of these people that are in there, you know, they're waiting for support from other people. You know, they need to know that they can come out or whistleblow, or start to, you know, question and make questions internally, because there are people outside that are backing them up. And so that's a really important aspect with it all. But, you know, but message to policemen and women and council workers, you know, do you really think at the end of the day that you're not going to get trodden on as well? I know that you're being used, right, to enforce these things, but ultimately, when, you know, when there is not enough of the herd to keep raping and pillaging, and the money that's going in unlawful taxes, you know, the greedy want even more and more and more and more, do you not think that they're going to suddenly start taking your perks away and suddenly start treading on you once you've fulfilled the job that they wanted you to do?
In fact, is it not already happening?
It has already happened with, 500,000, you know, laid off or whatever.
Yeah, lots.
So, you know,
cuts in overtime, cuts in pay, having to reapply for your own job,
yeah,
loads of it.
So, you know, for those people, you know, accept, just as was the case for me, you know, accept that your ego's been stroked in many ways by given these great titles and, you know, whatever perks, all right, but ultimately, are you really that high up the ladder that you're not going to get squashed onto, okay? I would just say, look, you know, look at what kind of place it's all going to become if things continue the way they appear to be going. You know, and is that somewhere really that you want your family to exist in? Because, you know, ultimately, you will be forgiven by your peers.
There's just us.
We all have to wake up at some time, and we were all doing a job previous to that, you know, and prior to that waking up experience. So you will be forgiven, merely, you know, see it for what it is and just come say, hey, look, you know, I was conned like everyone else. You know, I fell for it. Yep, very funny. You know, it's a divine comedy. Very, very funny. Now let's get on with some serious business.
Yeah.
And make this, you know, make the planet what it's supposed to be.
Realise that if there are rules, it must be a game. And so if you're going to play the game, learn the rules.
Learn the rules, you know. Yeah. Absolutely. Absolutely.
And read the contract.
Read the contracts and understand exactly what you're getting into.
Yeah.
You know, and where possible, you know, well, I don't want to appear to be giving, you know, kind of suggestions or advice or whatever, but I was going to say, you know, where possible, don't take out loans and this, that and the other. It's not that you're taking out loans, it's just that these banks are just not operating correctly.
No.
You know, so we should be able to exchange energy for currency in the public. That's the way it should be working. Is that going to happen? I don't know.
I don't think there's any choice, is there, really, now? I think that was really brilliant, Simon. Yeah. I really enjoyed that.
Is that good?
Yeah. Yeah, I'd actually like to state as well another thing, which is to say that that the acts to which you've been referring in this interview or this discussion are all particularly worth looking at, because we personally spoke about them yesterday.
Yeah, yeah.
Some of them aren't even very long.
Yeah.
And they do say things in them that are absolutely amazing and really, really do give you, the people, instruments that will help you. You know, the law is on our side. Some of the statute is even.
Yeah.
But one of the main things here to realise is that these guys are not even obeying their own statutes.
Mm-hmm.
So, hence the point in perhaps not getting rid of your legal fiction altogether, but using it.
or even, you know, creating a private league, a private fiction, which is unregistered, you know. And I know we spoke about this yesterday, but you know, certainly, you know, I've thought about a family. I mean, we are one family. I don't know whether you'd want to give it a label, whether that's being just as bad as what's been perpetrated, but, you know, perhaps to identify with that family, for those that want to use it, perhaps the family name DeWitt's Child might be used, and, you know, there's a dual meaning to that, of wits, as in humour, humour's child, but also it's Dutch for white shield.
DeWitt's Child.
Now, you know, anyone's free to adopt that, as far as I'm concerned, and be part of that family.
And when they say, "Are you Mr. DeWitt's Child?" you can say, "Which one?"
Which one? But moreover, you know, if it's myself, I'm going to probably use the title Principal or Master for the public. But again, that DeWitt's Child, it's been mentioned about coats of arms. And the relevance of having perhaps a family coat of arms, well, it's going to be a white shield as the coat of arms, so that's probably easy to put onto some letterhead.
Yes.
Yeah, so feel free to utilise that.
Yeah, very good.
Well, there you go, the fantastic Spaniard there, giving us many, many things, I'm sure, to think about. And I'd like to emphasise, just listening to that, it reminds me that... if you do manage to get enough meaningless promissory tokens together to kind of, or get yourself a crew ticket, or one way or the other, find your way into these festivals where people like Avalon Rising and the Truth Juice guys and all of that, if you can get yourself into places where they're operating, then there's a tendency to be able to get at their presenters for the kind of 2 or 3 days of the festival. They really don't go away. And a lot of the material that you've been hearing in these first Dr. Rock's radio shows have been coming just from, you know, hanging around, eating breakfast, drinking tea, and talking with people. And sometimes there's 6, 7, 8 of us all together swapping ideas for many hours at a time. And it occurred to me the other day that really, in the old days, I used to spend money to get into festivals and things, and it used to cost me a fortune in the various things I needed to keep my head in the right space, and the beer and the food and all of this sort of stuff. And I didn't get anything out of it at all, apart from seeing a load of, you know, commercial outfits out there banging out a lot of noise, which was in itself a lot of fun. But nowadays, if you can get into these things, they are real learning fests. I mean, there's good music there as well. There's even good beer nowadays too. What I'm going to do is I'm going to play a couple of tunes, give you time to recover, because that was quite a long session all in one go. And then, because the Freemen of Waterford are out there doing their thing on the large player, there's nobody to hustle me off the airwaves. So I'm hoping to come back, play a bit more music, and talk a little bit about some of the things that the Spaniard was saying, because just like Truth Juice Dave last week, who I didn't have a chance to thank because of my technical problems, thanks Dave for doing last week's, there's a lot of detail. There were many, many things that flew by us. It will, of course, as soon as I'm able, be available as a podcast, but in the meantime, whilst it's fresh in our minds, I'd like to revisit a few of the more interesting points that were made. In the meantime, I'll play a couple of tunes. I'll be back with you soon. That was the Clash there, and Julie's been working for the Drug Squad. This is, you're back live with Dr. Rock's radio show on tnsradio.com. We've got a bit of extra time, because we're on the Slew Player tonight, and we've been listening to a talk with the Spaniard, a gentleman who's working with a large number of people who together are known as the White Rabbit Education Group. And, I just thought it'd be worth running through a few of the things that he talked about, because he really did cover a lot of ground in the time that we were listening to him. And I thought one of the most interesting things was that he'd had what might be regarded as a kind of a right-on education. He'd had, you know, got everything he needed, and that gave him the chance of joining the bank or the army or the police or the NHS or going to university, which is where you kind of end up. I remember when I first tried to get myself a job via a job centre, I went in there with all of my various qualifications, and they told me that I was going on the clerical list and that I couldn't really have a job with spanners, and a job with spanners was what I was after. So we were forced to tear up all the paperwork and actually kind of get out there and go and find the sort of job that I wanted. But so that kind of choice arrives with all of us, really, I guess, if we're lucky enough. And certainly I think things were a bit different in those days, but our friend chose to work for Coutts, which is a pretty good place to start. I would imagine that he must have been pretty much on the ball from the word go, to be able to do that. And he also fairly quickly realised that he wasn't moving as fast as he wanted. So, you know, when a young mind enters a place like this and engages with the things that are going on around it and sets its intention and its attention on, I don't know, the environment, you know, it's a very, very lively place. You've come out of education. There is loads of stuff going on that you've never encountered before. In fact, to a great extent, I think, for me, it's possible to say that your education doesn't start until you leave education and start working. And there you are, you know, deeply receptive, enthusiastic, turning up, wanting to do the best that you can. And so you do. And for the Spaniard, he was in there for 17 years, I think. And he didn't, like he says, he didn't know. He was obviously, he's a bright man, fully informed, fully trained, moving from job to job, doing the things that he's being paid to do and being, you know, pretty good at them as far as we can tell. And he didn't know, even though he was working in the industry. And he says himself, and it's fair enough, you know, when you know what you're doing, you do know that you know that. And he regarded himself as, you know, informed. He put the hours in, put the time in, did the work. And yet, despite all of that, for 17 years, he had no idea just exactly what it was that he was visiting on his customers, on his clients. No idea at all. And I think even maybe 2 or 3 years ago, I'd have found it quite bizarre to find myself sitting at the end of a microphone saying such things. But I know that those of you that are out there listening to this have kind of like, have had this same realization. You can be doing something for a given amount of time and your mind's fully behind it, you know what's going on, and then suddenly the carpet's just pulled completely out from under your feet and you realise that everything is, as the Spaniard put it, somehow you're 180 degrees away, exactly 180 degrees away from where you were, pointed in exactly a different direction with a completely different view. And for the Spaniard, it was no law dictionary. He said, I didn't know what was going on because I was using the wrong dictionary effectively. And this is something that we hear again and again, isn't it? It's amazing how much power words have to affect us and affect the lives we have. So there he was, beavering away for 17 years, doing all the mortgages and what have you. And the absence of a law dictionary meant that he didn't know what the words meant on the bits of paper that he was kind of passing over. And he actually left banking, in a way, I mean, I suppose 17 years, that's a long time to be doing one thing, I think, anyway, but he'd sort of moved on. By the time realisation dawned, by the time he fell down the rabbit hole or travelled through the looking glass or whatever metaphor we want to use, he'd already left banking, which meant that he wasn't actually ever, I think, directly faced with the, you know, the sort of strange dichotomy, perhaps going into, maybe as much as going into work one day believing one set of things and coming out the, and going in the next day believe, well, knowing that another set of things are true. That really is how quickly it can happen. But he was elsewhere when that occurred, so it meant that he didn't actually have that kind of challenge in himself. But he was close enough to the banking experience, as it were, to the retail banking experience, to think, well, you know, even on the basis of service, you just can't treat people like that. And that was one of his, I think it sounds like it was one of his first realizations. It was one of mine as well, that really, you know, you can go along paying your money and dealing honestly with everybody. Because we all know, don't we, that to lie to people, to mislead them is not helping anybody. So dealing honestly with people is, you hope to get back what you put out there. That's as you reap, so shall you sow. But of course we don't necessarily realise that dealing with human flesh and blood, human beings, on a face-to-face and a balanced basis is one thing, but dealing with corporations on that sort of basis is something quite else. And once you kind of realise that there's been a bit of sleight of hand and some things have been put in front of you that are not as they appear, then very, very quickly, many, many other things fall away from you. So he'd left banking. He decided you just can't treat people like that, which was fair enough. And I think he started taking up his own stuff first, because what happened was, again, the same thing has happened to many, many, many of us, is that you're kind of working along, you've set up a business, you're doing this, you're doing that, you're earning the money, the cash flow's coming in and out, the punters are phoning up, you're getting the jobs done, you're getting things, I don't know, whatever it is, put on the ground, bought and sold, all of that. And then suddenly a decision that's made by, you know, somewhere out in the bigger environment, it sort of changes everything. It can change everything. You can, you know, find yourself going from having, say, 3, 4, 5, 6 months work as a self-employed person, and 2 or 3 phone calls as a result of things completely beyond your control can completely remove all of that. And then suddenly you find yourself needing to, you know, do new things. And this is exactly how the Spaniard found himself, because basically, one or other of the recessions or necessary economic adjustments or whatever it is we want to call it, whatever it was, the tide went out on his businesses. And he found that his straw man, his legal fiction, was basically high and dry. And so it was necessary for him to start taking some sort of action, and being, you know, having the knowledge he did, he went to court and was, as he put it, treated poorly by a judge. And this raised warning signs for him. So he was kind of approaching this awakening strictly from the kind of banking, from the corporate, from his own personal experience. And once he found himself in court trying to defend whatever position it was that he was trying to defend, he discovered that the judge was in no way sympathetic. Possibly like Daryl's man, like Chris Field, his evidence perhaps was completely stubborn. We're just not going to listen to it. And there's another line of awakening. And the thing is, in my experience, this is the way it happens. You realise one thing which leads you to do something, and that action will lead to another awakening, which leads to a bit of a reaction. But I thought the Spaniard was really good, the way he described that, sort of actually turning up in court and being treated poorly by a judge. And over time, I mean, this takes maybe, it's got to take a few weeks, I guess, for this to sort of sink in. But in the long run, he said it took several months. The implications of upholding the truth, as he put it, were just so massive that he just kind of shook and cried. And I can understand exactly how he feels there. I know that when I first started discovering this kind of stuff, started realizing that almost everything I understood was turning out to be completely the opposite of what it set out to be, some friendly people, very friendly and supportive people, suggested that there would be times when falling down the rabbit hole that you thought you were never going to reach the bottom. And obviously you've got really no point of reference. If the ground's gone and you're falling, you don't know where the bottom is and you can't remember where the top was, then you know, the human system can have a little bit of a difficulty on getting to grips with that, because there is nothing real. There's nothing to get to grips with. And that's pretty much what happened to the Spaniard as well. I think you just discover more and more and more stuff, until eventually you do get to this point where you realise that you can't just not do anything or not say anything. And that's a big shock after years and years of not believing that, of believing that you were being treated with honourably, and believing that, you know, everything was as it should be. And so the Spaniard's question was, do I ignore this and do I go with it? And of course, that's never a question, is it? There's never a question. If you discover suddenly that you've been unknowingly doing people over just because you didn't understand the words, then to continue to do that possibly would be a very difficult option to take. And really, it's just so appalling that really you have to stand up and start doing something about it. And we find ourselves in this kind of this split state. But it's so huge, you know, in many cases, as has been brought up on this program and on other programs I know, there's many, many people who remain asleep simply because they can't afford to believe that the kind of stuff we're finding to be true is true. And that kind of drive, together with the fact that the world management team, or the powers that be, or were, or whatever we want to call them, it just can't afford for us to understand how this works, how money is created, how all of it, how the legal fiction is created. They can't afford for us to find out what this is like, and many of us cannot afford to believe that it is true. And those two things together are what's really weaving the kind of reality that we find amongst ourselves. But at the same time, I think everybody's becoming aware of how things are changing. One of the things that the Spaniard touched on was competition as against cooperation. We find ourselves constantly in a state of competition, constantly in a state of polarization. And that means that one person cannot tell another person what's going on. You know, everything is on the basis of competitive advantage and secret information and all of that. And nobody's telling anybody else. If we were all explaining to each other what we were finding and combining our ideas, would we not come up with far quicker and better results? So, in his research, the Spaniard discovered many people had uncovered all this stuff before. The parties have been operating this way for hundreds and hundreds of years, so it keeps getting kind of swept under the carpet or blown away. And we're in a unique position here. We're actually able to talk to each other, we're able to listen to other people, we're able to garner experience. Fantastic TNS radio streaming all sorts of stuff live into our sitting rooms, which enables us to know that we are not alone. And now that we know, you know, let us play. That's got to be it, hasn't it? You know, once you know what's going on, once you know it's a game, once you know that you have this, like, fictional playing piece which you can or you might or might not choose to abandon, now we know, let us play. And if we're going to play, we should do our best to understand the rules such as they are, or such as they reveal themselves to be. That is the thing. That is the thing. Because one of the things the Spaniard and Vin point out, in fact, is that nobody likes to be cornered. Nobody likes to be cornered. And so, you know, we need to play the game, dodge around, learn what we're doing. And there's the fear and the scariness. The very first time you decide to take advantage of the fact that you found out that some things are not quite what they appear to be, and the very first time you decide to engage with whatever member of the management team it is that you choose to engage with, it being anything from your lowly parking warden up through policemen to bailiffs to whatever, the first time you do it, it's a performance. Your heart will rise into your throat. You get, like the Spaniard says, the adrenaline speeds in to sharpen up your responses and to keep you attentive. And these are all really, really useful things. But the fear and the scariness of first challenging, it's an alleged authority. Eventually it kind of goes away. It is our God-given right to ask questions. It's our duty to ask questions, especially in times when it is quite apparent that even the rules such as they are not always being obeyed by the people who are trying to enforce the same rules. So the Spaniard, as many, many other people have said, it is our God-given right to ask questions. If we're not happy about something, if we don't understand something, you know, we should ask. We should ask, because the worst that can happen is people are going to hang up on us or going to tell us that we're crazy or something. But one of the things about asking questions is it's not only you that might learn, of course. Asking questions gets you into a direct relationship with the mind and the heart and the energy system of the person or whatever of whom you're asking questions. You're actually engaging in the game, and it's going to get hugely different responses. Your positive engagement with the thing will get different responses from just going with the flow. You know, fear of rocking the boat, fear of actually getting myself into any trouble. The trouble we're getting ourselves into is because we're not asking questions, and because we're acquiescing to what corporations are doing to us, and we're yielding to our own fear. And it is only an alleged authority. It's only an alleged authority. All these things are alleged authorities. They work for us. We are the authority. Everything is prepaid. We shouldn't have to pay. And even if we should have to pay, we can't pay, because there is no money. All of the money is debt. All of the money is debt. And the only thing we can come up with is a promise to pay. And whether that promise to pay is in the form of notes that we hand over to people, or whether the promise to pay is just in the form of a promise to make good whatever it is that you've just kind of exchanged with the other person, it's still a promise to pay. The actual payment will come in the exercise of your energy, not necessarily in the handing over of the notes. So we can't pay, we can only promise to pay, and then if we are going to actually fulfil that promise, it's going to be through actions, not through handing over bits of paper one way or the other. We need to recognise that common sense tells us that we can't understand 65,000 statutes, and that being the wealth of the nation, that we have the right to stand where we are and use our common sense to make sense of the world. Mutual reliance on each other. So cooperation rather than competition. One of the things that competition does is it yields two brands of cola, Pepsi and Coke, neither of which are particularly good. Presumably, somewhere a long time ago, there might even have been a cola that was good for us, but it will have been well and truly eaten up by this constant growing of companies and buying of them and growing of that and the buying of the next thing. What we need is mutual reliance, not competition. At best, as I said, co-opetition. You know, we obviously we've got to compete a little bit, haven't we? When push comes to shove, that's where progress comes from. But by and large, we would get so much more, as the Spaniard said. Very, very few minds working together, concentrating on a problem, assessing it, working out what might be done about it, and then enacting their decisions. It is massively powerful. And you can't really, until you've tried it, you can't believe how huge these things can be. And there will be no sudden awakening. That was another thing that he said. That, and again, I think this is down to the fact that there's a whole band of people who can't afford to let everybody know what's going on. There's also a whole band of people who really don't want to know, can't afford to know. Can't afford to know. Better to assume that everything is all right than to know that maybe it isn't. This all lends a huge inertia to the system. And the Spaniards anticipating kind of a slow awakening, as it were. I think that's what we're experiencing now. But in the end, because we're all connected, there may well just be a wave of change. Things could happen really, really quickly, all of a sudden. But it is inevitable. You know, we can resist and deny, but as soon as we discover what's going on, then we have to move on, I think. You know, we don't have any choice, do we? And we're aiding and abetting the system. But everything is correctable, and knowing is enough. As soon as we know what's going on, that's enough for us to start making the changes we need. People have been stroking our ego, dangling the carrot, keeping us in fear, all of that. As soon as we realise that's going on, then, and stop paying attention to it, stop putting our attention onto it, then things really begin changing. And so, you know, you might get, like the Spaniard says, an expected railroading at the county court, having realised what judges are about. But of course the expected railroading, if it comes about as a result of your expectations. We are the surety for the whole system, he said. You can move for or on behalf of any company. Any of us can do that because we're living, we have will, we can move, we can make decisions, we can think, we can handle things, and companies can't do that. And one of the earliest cases that the Spaniard found himself involved in, he found the judge as one of the manoeuvres that is, I think, quite frequently taken, found himself with an order against him for £15,000, I think it was, for the costs of the people who were executing the prosecution, as far as I can gather it. And he stepped straight in now. I think there's a fair point in the Freeman movement that we need to be reasonable in the charges that we make. We need to be reasonable in the way that we deal with people. Because if we want a rational outcome as opposed to the irrational state that we've got at the moment, then reasonableness is going to be at the key, at the bottom of that. And that being one of the basic, one of my basic, I guess, approaches to life, I thought it was quite amusing that the Spaniard, having been brought up in banking, should charge him £1 million for turning up. and then charge it, give him £100 million bill for the orders that had been laid on him by the judge, and to have £500 million riding on the bond that he put on the whole case, because that is just, isn't it, that's £601 million in response to a charge of £15,000 or whatever it was. But you know, hey, why not? Given that the whole thing's a game, and you know the rules, and all orders are chargeable, and your time is, you know, and you've got to be there, and why should you be there, and all of that, then why not? I thought this was very impressive. I enjoyed that quite a lot. And he also said, you know, on the affidavits, we try to give all, you know, 14 days maybe, followed by 10 days or what have you. And he said, you know, if you're under pressure, just give them 3 days. It's fair enough. I mean, they do that to you. This is what's happening all the time. Shaft back, perhaps. So, surety the whole system. So there he was, and he found himself with all of these debts because the financial tide had kind of ran away from him and all of that, and 9 out of the 13 positions that he found himself in, as he describes them, they just gave up. Over time, as a result of the letters backwards and forwards and things, they left him alone. So, we're effectively our fictional game piece. We kind of give it energy, and we're more valuable than gold. He says, money oversees the whole game, and it's become king. It was our servant, and now it leads, and we can see how that's the case. And it's a sort of, it's one of those strange things, isn't it? It's said that in the kingdom of the blind, the one-eyed man can convince everybody else that he's king. But actually all, it's just necessary for another blind man to convince the rest of them that he's got one eye. And that's sort of what's been going on here. He wasn't worried at all, of course, about bankruptcy, because it's not him, the flesh and blood human being, that's going to bankruptcy. It's the straw man. It's this fictitious legal entity that's going into that. It's already bankrupt. The straw man is already bankrupt, because the system of which it is a facet, of which it is an expression, is also bankrupt. And it's all a fiction anyway. So there we go. The multifaceted person, it kind of exists. It exists as long as we give it our power, and then the whole of this legal fictional world becomes real. And we touched a little bit on weddings and the fact that you have to use your legal fiction to get married, and that there's registration involved there, which means handing over superior rights or what have you. But the Spaniard had a much lighter attitude to his fiction, a bit like Litmus, who we spoke to last week. Litmus is out there living free, and he's made friends with his legal fiction. He deals with people who want to try and stop him from doing what he's doing and things. The Spaniard says the legal fiction is, you know, it's a license, if you like, to engage in commerce and engage with positively. You can use it for that, but it's a mask. It's something you can hide behind. It's a trust. It's a trust. Nearly everything's a trust. And when you're in court, that's how the court authorities are regarding it. It can be a probate estate. It can be the master of a vessel. It can be and is the beneficiary of a trust. The legal fiction is all of these things. And the argument of a man who's been within the system selling the stuff and what have you is that all of these things are valid ways of approaching our means of interacting with the powers that be, as it were. But having said that, you know, we can't just do that, really. We can't just engage with the legal fiction or the trust or however it is we want to do it without looking at the state of the world that we find ourselves in. And the Spaniard quite rightly asked the question, you know, you've certainly got to find yourself looking around and saying, can this really be done any better? You know, trying to take everything means getting everything, but really having has got to mean sharing things with people. We can't continue to compete to smaller and smaller levels. And yet, by definition, companies are in competition with each other, and just as the companies are in competition with each other, then the people within those companies are in competition as well, and all of that is making it difficult for us to, you know, do anything other than tread on people, try and cling on to the greasy pole. there's no movement in that process towards what we need, and the realizations that we're having are leading to movement in that kind of direction. And he says, like we say, if you can show, if you can demonstrate that somebody's had their hand in the cookie jar, and you can write down, you know, we have all of this stuff to show that the cookies have gone missing and that it's your hand that's been in there and all of that, and it's quite clear. In fact, we've even seen it in documents that you said you've more or less written down, yes, I have my hand in the cookie jar on a regular basis. So how many times do we have to kind of hand in, you know, 14 days, then 14 days? There has to be a point when, at some point, we've got an unrebuttable claim, and you've got to be able to say this is where it stops. And that is effectively what so many people are trying to do now, because if all of your money is debt and everything has already been paid for and you are the value of the nation, then when do you get to get your own hand in the cookie jar? When do we get to get some of the cookies? When do we get the keys to the mansion on the hill? And one of the interesting differences to the Spaniards' information to the things I've been doing is I'd always kind of assumed that an affidavit needs your own signature on it and maybe that of a witness. But the Spaniard points out that if you get three signatures on it, then it effectively you become a tribunal. As we know, this is sort of roughly equivalent to notarizing a document. But the Spaniard used the words that you've achieved a foreign jurisdiction judgment by achieving lawful estoppel. If you've put a load of stuff forward and the other party has not come forward and managed to rebut them and has not managed to say to you, no, this is not the way it is and I can show that it's not the way it is, then you've got this lawful estoppel, it's not approachable, it's a gate that is closed to them. We asked you to come through and all of that and you haven't, so now we're going to lock the gate. And the words that the Spaniard used were foreign jurisdiction judgment. And many I know, because I've been watching the chat boxes and listening to TNS and all, and there's many cases where people have written to, I don't know, their council or what have you, the example that was, or you know, the sample that was quoted, yet people have written to the council or what have you saying, you know, show to me that I have a contract with you, show to me that I am actually liable for this and not some person that was created at my time of birth, show me this stuff and that stuff, and all you get simply back is a demand for money, and eventually you might get a summons, and if you don't go then there'll be a liability order, and then bailiffs will come around and all of that. And all of this is we know just in our hearts, don't we? We know that this can't be quite right. It's a bit the same as somebody saying to you that if you don't fill in a form you can have a criminal record and £1,000 fine. There's sort of no, so in a sense, say take your council tax, there might well be no bill payable to start with. This has been sort of shown in several courts anyway, but you know, if somebody can't show you the contract, and if somebody can't show you that you actually, the flesh and blood person, are liable for all of these monies, then you must assume that there's no bill payable. The person that are making the claim cannot document and verify the claim that's being made. Plus the fact that you maybe put in three affidavits saying, look, it's my understanding that I don't owe you this money because, or, you know, maybe I do, but prove to me that you do in 14 days. And then if they don't, you say, show me, and I'll give you another 14 days. And eventually you have to say, look, you know, I can see you nicking the cookies and I don't want to have any more of it. And that is a foreign jurisdiction judgment. But it's known, as was pointed out, that the magistrates' court, it seems to be quite likely that in most cases what's happening is the council are simply hiring a room in the court and they're putting their own staff in there, which is contrary to Human Rights Act. And we require an independent tribunal, that's what we have a right to, and yet somehow these are the people that are kind of raising the bills and then taking you to court, and they are the cause and the kind of outcome of the problem that we've got. Quite apart from those things which are problems in themselves, because obviously if the council who are charging you the rates or what have you it is that they're after are also the people who are occupying the room that you're going to sort out the adjudication in, then obviously there's a failure of independence, quite apart from anything else. But also it seems pretty likely that in most cases, if not in all cases, the judge is being paid. And if he's being paid, then obviously we've got to wonder whether the independence is assured. Quite often there isn't a tribunal. Quite often there's only one, not three. So all of that, we could put down to misrepresentation, 1967 Misrepresentation Act. The bailiffs, by the bailiffs arriving, apparently the 1689 Bill of Rights Act could be looked at, because we've been, effectively, our day in court hasn't happened. We've entered into an administrative process, which is to say, okay, you're making this claim on me, well, that's fair enough, but I've got a right to this, or that, or the other. And the idea is, obviously, that you bat the ball backwards and forwards, you kind of make sure that all the terms are right, but there's none of this going on. There's none of this going on when you're kind of engaged with this kind of game of ping pong or what have you. All there is a computer which effectively turns out loads and loads of different sizes and shapes of form, which says, say, give us your bloody money. That's all that's going on. There's no, you can't actually engage at all, one way or the other. So, there we've got the Human Rights Act, the Misrepresentation Act, the Bill of Rights, because if bailiffs are sent and you haven't had before you've had your day in court, and anyway, your lawful estoppel in your foreign jurisdiction judgment denies jurisdiction. And apparently you can apply to the courts, you can get a form, and you can show that this is the case, and this effectively, your form points out that your own personal court, your tribunal, with your three signatures on the bottom of your affidavit or whatever, has already decided on this matter, and that there is indeed no right to take it any further, there is no jurisdiction, recognising the foreign judgment jurisdiction is part of the De La Hague Convention, apparently. So, it's taken us a fair way through that. I'm going to have to go and get myself a drink, because my mouth's getting really dry here. I hope you're still with me. I'm going to play a tune or so, come back and then finish off. It's, we're told, 20 to 10 on Thursday the 23rd of June. We're still here. I'll be with you very shortly. There we go. Johnny Cash and When the Man Comes to Town. Well, of course, we realise, don't we, folks, that we need not be so cautious as we need to be, used to be, when the man comes to town. For a start off, it's an offence against the law to try to enforce legal jurisdiction against a flesh and blood man. This is an unrebuttable fact of common law. And so, if despite three affidavits from a flesh and blood human being, whoever it is that we're dealing with insists on issuing liability orders and trying to get us into some sort of legislative system, then they are causing an offence against the man. And so if, you know, you're the first letter back from them after the three affidavits, the Spaniard rightly points out, shows that they have not, either they haven't read, or they haven't understood, or they've willfully ignored whatever it is that you're trying to say to them, and that means that they may be incompetent. They're certainly unsuitable to be in receipt of the thoughtful approaches that are coming to them from the human being. And so, you know, they're maybe not suitable to be there. The first letter back is like that. So one of the things that was pointed out is that if a solicitor attempts to enforce legal jurisdiction against a man, because it is against the law, he is inviting action from the solicitor's regulatory authority, who I think are called the solicitor's regulatory authority, given the usual imagination that these things are done with. And the Spaniard says the SRA told him they would prosecute people who do that. So, you know, it's maybe worth bringing to people's attention that's what's happening. The thing is, there are a myriad approaches. I really enjoyed the Spaniard because there's such a wealth and texture to what he knows. And of course I heard it all in the context of half a dozen other people at the Sunrise Celebration who are speaking with him as well as with me. But basically, one of the things that we all concluded was correct was that when you're awake, you're awake. And there's nothing you can do about it. There's no way you can go backwards. Once you know what's going on, it's extremely difficult to not know anymore. Once you've taken the red pill, taking the blue pill is not going to wipe out the information. And then there's just the drive for action. All of us feel this. We can, because how else are you going to do? You just take it anymore. And then it's important to realize this kind of critical mass that we've got here, this number of people that, you know, TNS Radio, Scottish Sovereigns on the Land .ning.com, all the Freemen on the Land, FMOTL.com, the Freemen League, the People's United Community, the Parallel Community, the all of these people that we're talking to, and we're not only, we're meeting each other on the web, we're doing radio together, we're meeting each other in the field and talking about all of these things. Our immediate predecessors, the people who were doing this maybe a generation or two generations ago, were operating without all of that support. They were out there bravely stepping out onto quicksand, testing stuff in courts for our benefit. And had they not been out doing that, then perhaps there's a chance that we would not be able to be here doing what we're doing. So we owe them a huge debt of gratitude. But also we should remember that we are in a place where we can talk to each other. Every challenge that we meet, we can talk with other people. There's, as Chris Field said, there's safety in a wide variety of advice sources. That's what we need. There's safety and rectitude that way, and we have that. So if we make use of it, and we listen to this stuff, and we enact it as best as we can, then we will start making progress. And one of the last questions I asked the Spaniard was whether he'd encountered any adverse effects as a result of stepping out of the system and starting to take, if you like, starting to take the game to them, starting to use it for his own benefit. And he said no. He said there was nothing that he would define as a negative result. He said quite, you know, in the usual course of things, he'd had visits from bailiffs. But that apart from that, his desire to stand up and challenge almost every aspect of what was for him a means of making his living. For 17 years he was making his living doing this stuff, and yet by stepping outside it, you could hear the enthusiasm in his voice, you could hear the enthusiasm in him that this is really it's a new way for us to behave. And the thing is, it's so easy to just let somebody else do the job. It's so easy to go, oh, you know, like he says, I've got a bunch of totally unqualified people to run the country, you know, we don't really need to be interested in it. Well, before I fell down the rabbit hole, we were already personally encountering here in my house the kind of fact that there isn't anybody out there apart from we the people. We had a bit of an encounter, well, one of our household had a bit of an encounter with a dog whilst out walking, and the dog bit this person really quite severely on the thigh, and its teeth went through several layers of clothing and left a wound that was there for several weeks afterwards. And our subsequent endeavour to involve the RSPCA, I think it was, necessitated getting the police involved, and every single time anybody was phoned up, we had to reiterate every single bit of information we had to give before, including getting the maps out to describe where the farm was and where the dog was. And it just went on and on and on, and in the long run, I think the RSPCA did make some sort of visit to the place, but only on the understanding that somebody else had been bitten by a dog, and that actually the dog that has turned out to be really nice and all of that. And really our conclusion was that we would have been far better dealing with it ourselves. So, you know, the person whose dog it was needed to know what was going on, because there's people with kind of, you know, holiday lets and children and all of that down the road. But it's like we've just got into the habit of telling somebody else to do it. I think the Spaniard's basic message, and the whole message of all of us, I'm sure, is that this is no longer the case. It's time to stand up and, you know, do your own thing, really. It's extremely expensive for us not to be doing that, and if we do start doing that, it gets extremely expensive for somebody else. So there I am. I've come to the end of an extra hour, amazingly enough. I'm sorry if I've been going on a bit. Maybe I have. But enjoy your legal fiction, use it, abuse it, drop it, do what you like. It's all really fantastic. I'm really glad to have been listening to all of these people, and I'll be with you again next Thursday when I'm not quite sure what'll be happening, but I think we'll probably be enjoying a little bit of a change of tone and talking about maybe the act of walking right the way across England between Beltane and the summer solstice in the year 2008. I'll see what else crops up. I'll be with you then. Thanks very much for listening, folks. See you soon.